Fantasties, a fairy romance for men and women. Chapter 1. A Spirit. The undulating and silent well, and rippling rivulet, and evening gloom, now deepening the dark shades, for speech assuming, held commune with him, as if he and it were all that was. Shelley's Alistair. I awoke one morning with the usual perplexity of mind which accompanies the return of consciousness. As I lay and looked through the eastern window of my room, a faint streak of peach color, dividing a cloud that just rose above a low swell of the horizon, announced the approach of the sun. As my thoughts, which a deep and apparently dreamless sleep had dissolved, began again to assume crystalline forms, the strange events of the foregoing night presented themselves anew to my wondering consciousness. The day before had been my 1/20th birthday. Among other ceremonies investing me with my legal rights, the keys of an old secretary, in which my father had kept his private papers, had been delivered up to me. As soon as I was left alone, I ordered lights in the chamber where the secretary stood, the first lights that had been there for many a year, for, since my father's death, the room had been left undisturbed. But, as if the darkness had been too long an inmate to be easily expelled, and had dyed with blackness the walls to which, bat-like, it had clung, these tapers served but ill to light up the gloomy hangings, and seemed to throw yet darker shadows into the hollows of the deep-wrought cornice. All the further portions of the room lay shrouded in a mystery whose deepest folds were gathered around the dark oak cabinet which I now approached with a strange mingling of reverence and curiosity. Perhaps, like a geologist, I was about to turn up to the light some of the buried strata of the human world, with its fossil remains charred by passion and petrified by tears. Perhaps I was to learn how my father, whose personal history was unknown to me, had woven his web of story, how he had found the world, and how the world had left him. Perhaps I was to find only the records of lands and monies, how gotten and how secured, coming down from strange men, and through troublous times, to me, who knew little or nothing of them all. To solve my speculations, and to dispel the awe which was fast gathering around me as if the dead were drawing near, I approached the secretary, and having found the key that fitted the upper portion, I opened it with some difficulty, drew near it a heavy high-backed chair, and sat down before a multitude of little drawers and slides and pigeonholes. But the door of a little cupboard in the center especially attracted my interest, as if there lay the secret of this long-hidden world. Its key I found. One of the rusty hinges cracked and broke as I opened the door. It revealed a number of small pigeonholes. These, however, being but shallow compared with the depth of those around the little cupboard, the outer ones reaching to the back of the desk, I concluded that there must be some accessible space behind, and found, indeed, that they were formed in a separate framework, which admitted of the whole being pulled out in one piece. Behind, I found a sort of flexible portcullis of small bars of wood laid close together horizontally. After long search, and trying many ways to move it, I discovered at last a scarcely projecting point of steel on one side. I pressed this repeatedly and hard with the point of an old tool that was lying near, till at length it yielded inwards, and the little slide, flying up suddenly, disclosed a chamber empty, except that in one corner lay a little heap of withered rose leaves, whose long-lived scent had long since departed, and, in another, a small packet of papers, tied with a bit of ribbon, whose color had gone with the rose scent. Almost fearing to touch them, they witnessed so mutely to the law of oblivion, I leaned back in my chair, and regarded them for a moment, when suddenly there stood on the threshold of the little chamber, as though she had just emerged from its depth, a tiny woman form, as perfect in shape as if she had been a small Greek statuette roused to life and motion. Her dress was of a kind that could never grow old-fashioned, because it was simply natural, a robe plaited in a band around the neck, and confined by a belt about the waist, descended to her feet. It was only afterwards, however, that I took notice of her dress, although my surprise was by no means of so overpowering a degree as such an apparition might naturally be expected to excite. Seeing, however, as I suppose, some astonishment in my countenance, she came forward within a yard of me, and said, in a voice that strangely recalled a sensation of twilight, and reedy river banks, and a low wind, even in this deathly room, dash. Anitus, you never saw such a little creature before, did you?
No, said I. And indeed I hardly believe I do now.
Ah. That is always the way with you men, you believe nothing the first time, and it is foolish enough to let mere repetition convince you of what you consider in itself unbelievable. I am not going to argue with you, however, but to grant you a wish. Here I could not help interrupting her with a foolish speech, of which, however, I had no cause to repent. How can such a very little creature as you grant or refuse anything?
Is that all the philosophy you have gained in 1 and 20 years? Said she. Form is much, but size is nothing. It is a mere matter of relation. I suppose your 6-foot lordship does not feel altogether insignificant, though to others you do look small beside your old Uncle Ralph, who rises above you a great half-foot at least. But size is of so little consequence with old me, that I may as well accommodate myself to your foolish prejudices. So saying, she leapt from the desk upon the floor, where she stood a tall, gracious lady, with pale face and large blue eyes. Her dark hair flowed behind, wavy but uncurled, down to her waist, and against it her form stood clear in its robe of white. Now, said she, you will believe me. Overcome with the presence of a beauty which I could now perceive, and drawn towards her by an attraction irresistible as incomprehensible, I suppose I stretched out my arms towards her, for she drew back a step or two, and said, Foolish boy, if you could touch me, I should hurt you. Besides, I was 237 years old, last Midsummer Eve, and a man must not fall in love with his grandmother, you know. But you are not my grandmother, said I. How do you know that? She retorted. I dare say you know something of your great-grandfather's a good deal further back than that, but you know very little about your great-grandmother's on either side. Now, to the point. Your little sister was reading a fairy tale to you last night. She was. When she had finished, she said, as she closed the book, Is there a fairy country, brother? You replied with a sigh, I suppose there is, if one could find the way into it. I did, but I meant something quite different from what you seem to think. Never mind what I seem to think. You shall find the way into fairyland tomorrow. Now look in my eyes. Eagerly I did so. They filled me with an unknown longing. I remembered somehow that my mother died when I was a baby. I looked deeper and deeper, till they spread around me like seas, and I sank in their waters. I forgot all the rest, till I found myself at the window, whose gloomy curtains were withdrawn, and where I stood gazing on a whole heaven of stars, small and sparkling in the moonlight. Below lay a sea, still as death and hoary in the moon, sweeping into bays and around capes and islands, away, away, I knew not whither. Alas! It was no sea, but a low bog burnished by the moon. Surely there is such a sea somewhere, said I to myself. A low sweet voice beside me replied. In fairy land, Anitus. I turned, but saw no one. I closed the secretary, and went to my own room, and to bed. All this I recalled as I lay with half-closed eyes. I was soon to find the truth of the lady's promise, that this day I should discover the road into fairyland. Chapter 2. Where is the stream? Cried he, with tears. Seest thou it's not in blue waves above us? He looked up, and lo! The blue stream was flowing gently over their heads. Nivalis, Heinrich von Alterdingen. While these strange events were passing through my mind, I suddenly, as one awakes to the consciousness that the sea has been moaning by him for hours, or that the storm has been howling about his window all night, became aware of the sound of running water near me, and, looking out of bed, I saw that a large green marble basin, in which I was wont to wash, and which stood on a low pedestal of the same material in a corner of my room, was overflowing like a spring, and that a stream of clear water was running over the carpet, all the length of the room, finding its outlet I knew not where. And, stranger still, where this carpet, which I had myself designed to imitate a field of grass and daisies, bordered the course of the little stream, the grass blades and daisies seemed to wave in a tiny breeze that followed the water's flow, while under the rivulet they bent and swayed with every motion of the changeful current, as if they were about to dissolve with it, and, forsaking their fixed form, become fluent as the waters. My dressing table was an old-fashioned piece of furniture of black oak, with drawers all down the front. These were elaborately carved in foliage, of which ivy formed the chief part. The nearer end of this table remained just as it had been, but on the further end a singular change had commenced. I happened to fix my eye on a little cluster of ivy leaves. The first of these was evidently the work of the carver, the next looked curious, the third was unmistakable ivy, and just beyond it a tendril of clematis had twined itself about the gilt handle of one of the drawers. Hearing next a slight motion above me, I looked up, and saw that the branches and leaves designed upon the curtains of my bed were slightly in motion. Not knowing what change might follow next, I thought it high time to get up, and, springing from the bed, my bare feet alighted upon a cool green sward, and although I dressed in all haste, I found myself completing my toilet under the boughs of a great tree, whose top waved in the golden stream of the sunrise with many interchanging lights, and with shadows of leaf and branch gliding over leaf and branch, as the cool morning wind swung it to and fro, like a sinking sea wave. After washing as well as I could in the clear stream, I rose and looked around me. The tree under which I seemed to have lain all night was one of the advance guard of a dense forest, towards which the rivulet ran. Faint traces of a footpath, much overgrown with grass and moss, and with here and there a pimpernel even, were discernible along the right bank. This, thought I, must surely be the path into fairyland, which the lady of last night promised I should so soon find. I crossed the rivulet, and accompanied it, keeping the footpath on its right bank, until it led me, as I expected, into the wood. Here I left it, without any good reason, and with a vague feeling that I ought to have followed its course, I took a more southerly direction. Chapter 3. Man doth usurp all space, stares thee, in rock, bush, river, in the face. Never thine eyes behold a tree, 'tis no sea thou seest in the sea, 'tis but a disguised humanity. To avoid thy fellow, vain thy plan, all that interests a man, is man. Henry Sutton. The trees, which were far apart where I entered, giving free passage to the level rays of the sun, closed rapidly as I advanced, so that ere long their crowded stems barred the sunlight out, forming as it were a thick grating between me and the east. I seemed to be advancing towards a second midnight. In the midst of the intervening twilight, however, before I entered what appeared to be the darkest portion of the forest, I saw a country maiden coming towards me from its very depths. She did not seem to observe me, for she was apparently intent upon a bunch of wild flowers which she carried in her hand. I could hardly see her face, for, though she came direct towards me, she never looked up. But when we met, instead of passing, she turned and walked alongside of me for a few yards, still keeping her face downwards, and busied with her flowers. She spoke rapidly, however, all the time, in a low tone, as if talking to herself, but evidently addressing the purport of her words to me. She seemed afraid of being observed by some lurking foe. "Trust the oak," said she, "trust the oak, and the elm, and the great beech. Take care of the birch, for though she is honest, she is too young not to be changeable. But shun the ash and the alder, for the ash is an ogre, you will know him by his thick fingers, and the alder will smother you with her web of hair, if you let her near you at night." All this was uttered without pause or alteration of tone. Then she turned suddenly and left me, walking still with the same unchanging gait. I could not conjecture what she meant, but satisfied myself with thinking that it would be time enough to find out her meaning when there was need to make use of her warning, and that the occasion would reveal the admonition. I concluded from the flowers that she carried, that the forest could not be everywhere so dense as it appeared from where I was now walking, and I was right in this conclusion. For soon I came to a more open part, and by crossed a wide grassy glade, on which were several circles of brighter green. But even here I was struck with the utter stillness. No bird sang. No insect hummed. Not a living creature crossed my way. Yet somehow the whole environment seemed only asleep, and to wear even in sleep an air of expectation. The trees seemed all to have an expression of conscious mystery, as if they said to themselves, "We could, and if we would." They had all a meaning look about them. Then I remembered that night is the fairies' day, and the moon their sun, and I thought everything sleeps and dreams now. When the night comes, it will be different. At the same time I, being a man and a child of the day, felt some anxiety as to how I should fare among the elves and other children of the night who wake when mortals dream, and find their common life in those wondrous hours that flow noiselessly over the moveless death-like forms of men and women and children, lying strewn and parted beneath the weight of the heavy waves of night, which flow on and beat them down, and hold them drowned and senseless, until the ebb tide comes, and the waves sink away, back into the ocean of the dark. But I took courage and went on. Soon, however, I became again anxious, though from another cause. I had eaten nothing that day, and for an hour past had been feeling the want of food. So I grew afraid lest I should find nothing to meet my human necessities in this strange place, but once more I comforted myself with hope and went on. Before noon, I fancied I saw a thin blue smoke rising amongst the stems of larger trees in front of me, and soon I came to an open spot of ground in which stood a little cottage, so built that the stems of four great trees formed its corners, while their branches met and intertwined over its roof, heaping a great cloud of leaves over it, up towards the heavens. I wondered at finding a human dwelling in this neighborhood, and yet it did not look altogether human, though sufficiently so to encourage me to expect to find some sort of food. Seeing no door, I went round to the other side, and there I found one, wide open. A woman sat beside it, preparing some vegetables for dinner. This was homely and comforting. As I came near, she looked up, and seeing me, showed no surprise, but bent her head again over her work, and said in a low tone, "Did you see my daughter?" "I believe I did," said I. "Can you give me something to eat, for I am very hungry?" "With pleasure," she replied, in the same tone, "but do not say anything more, till you come into the house, for the ash is watching us." Having said this, she rose and led the way into the cottage, which, I now saw, was built of the stems of small trees set closely together, and was furnished with rough chairs and tables, from which even the bark had not been removed. As soon as she had shut the door and set a chair, "You have fairy blood in you," said she, looking hard at me. "How do you know that?" "You could not have got so far into this wood if it were not so, and I am trying to find out some trace of it in your countenance. I think I see it." "What do you see?" "Oh, never mind, I may be mistaken in that." "But how then do you come to live here?" "Because I too have fairy blood in me." Here I, in my turn, looked hard at her, and thought I could perceive, notwithstanding the coarseness of her features, and especially the heaviness of her eyebrows, a something unusual. I could hardly call it grace, and yet it was an expression that strangely contrasted with the form of her features. I noticed too that her hands were delicately formed, though brown with work and exposure. "I should be ill," she continued, "if I did not live on the borders of the fairies' country, and now in the need of their food. And I see by your eyes that you are not quite free of the same need, though, from your education and the activity of your mind, you have felt it less than I. You may be further removed too from the fairy race." I remembered what the lady had said about my grandmother's. Here she placed some bread and some milk before me, with a kindly apology for the homeliness of the fare, with which, however, I was in no humor to quarrel. I now thought it time to try to get some explanation of the strange words both of her daughter and herself. "What did you mean by speaking so about the ash?" She rose and looked out of the little window. My eyes followed her, but as the window was too small to allow anything to be seen from where I was sitting, I rose and looked over her shoulder. I had just time to see, across the open space, on the edge of a denser forest, a single large ash tree, whose foliage showed bluish, amidst the truer green of the other trees around it, when she pushed me back with an expression of impatience and terror, and then almost shut out the light from the window by setting up a large old book in it. "In general," said she, recovering her composure, "there is no danger in the daytime, for then he is sound asleep, but there is something unusual going on in the woods. There must be some solemnity among the fairies tonight, for all the trees are restless, and although they cannot come awake, they see and hear in their sleep." "But what danger is to be dreaded from him?" Instead of answering the question, she went again to the window and looked out, saying she feared the fairies would be interrupted by foul weather, for a storm was brewing in the west. "And the sooner it grows dark, the sooner the ash will be awake," added she. I asked her how she knew that there was any unusual excitement in the woods. She replied, "Besides the look of the trees, the dog there is unhappy, and the eyes and ears of the white rabbit are redder than usual, and he frisks about as if he expected some fun. If the cat were at home, she would have her back up, for the young fairies pull the sparks out of her tail with bramble thorns, and she knows when they are coming. So do I, in another way." At this instant, a gray cat rushed in like a demon, and disappeared in a hole in the wall. "There, I told you," said the woman. "But what of the ash tree?" said I, returning once more to the subject. Here, however, the young woman, whom I had met in the morning, entered. A smile passed between the mother and daughter, and then the latter began to help her mother in little household duties. "I should like to stay here till the evening," I said, "and then go on my journey, if you will allow me." "You are welcome to do as you please, only it might be better to stay all night, than risk the dangers of the wood then. Where are you going?" "Nay, that I do not know," I replied, "but I wish to see all that is to be seen, and therefore I should like to start just at sundown. You are a bold youth, if you have any idea of what you are daring, but a rash one, if you know nothing about it, and, excuse me, you do not seem very well informed about the country and its manners. However, no one comes here but for some reason, either known to himself or to those who have charge of him, so you shall do just as you wish." Accordingly I sat down, and feeling rather tired, and disinclined for further talk, I asked leave to look at the old book which still screened the window. The woman brought it to me directly, but not before taking another look towards the forest, and then drawing a white blind over the window. I sat down opposite to it by the table, on which I laid the great old volume, and read. It contained many wondrous tales of fairyland, and olden times, and the knights of King Arthur's table. I read on and on, till the shades of the afternoon began to deepen, for in the midst of the forest it gloomed earlier than in the open country. At length I came to this passage. Here it chanced, that upon their quest, Sir Galahad and Sir Percival were encountered in the depths of a great forest. Now, Sir Galahad was dight all in harness of silver, clear and shining, the which is a delight to look upon, but full hasty to tarnish, and withouten the labor of a ready squire, uneath to be kept fair and clean. And yet withouten squire or page, Sir Galahad's armor shone like the moon. And he rode a great white mare, whose bases and other housings were black, but all besprent with fair lilies of silver sheen. Whereas Sir Percival bestrode a red horse, with a tawny mane and tail, whose trappings were all besmirched with mud and mire, and his armor was wondrous rusty to behold, ne could he by any art furbish it again, so that as the sun in his going down shone twixt the bare trunks of the trees, full upon the knights twain, the one did seem all shining with light, and the other all to glow with ruddy fire. Now it came about in this wise. For Sir Percival, after his escape from the demon lady, when as the cross on the handle of his sword smote him to the heart, and he rove himself through the thigh, and escaped away, he came to a great wood, and, in no wise cured of his fault, yet bemoaning the same, the damosel of the alder tree encountered him, right fair to see, and with her fair words and false countenance she comforted him and beguiled him, until he followed her where she led him to a. Here a low hurried cry from my hostess caused me to look up from the book, and I read no more. "Look there," she said, "just look at his fingers." Just as I had been reading in the book, the setting sun was shining through a cleft in the clouds piled up in the west, and a shadow as of a large distorted hand, with thick knobs and humps on the fingers, so that it was much wider across the fingers than across the undivided part of the hand, passed slowly over the little blind, and then as slowly returned in the opposite direction. "He is almost awake, mother, and greedier than usual tonight." "Hush, child, you need not make him more angry with us than he is, for you do not know how soon something may happen to oblige us to be in the forest after nightfall." "But you are in the forest," said I, "how is it that you are safe here?" "He dares not come nearer than he is now," she replied, "for any of those four oaks, at the corners of our cottage, would tear him to pieces, they are our friends. But he stands there and makes awful faces at us sometimes, and stretches out his long arms and fingers, and tries to kill us with fright, for, indeed, that is his favorite way of doing. Pray, keep out of his way tonight." "Shall I be able to see these things?" said I. "That I cannot tell yet, not knowing how much of the fairy nature there is in you. But we shall soon see whether you can discern the fairies in my little garden, and that will be some guide to us." "Are the trees fairies too, as well as the flowers?" I asked. "They are of the same race," she replied, "though those you call fairies in your country are chiefly the young children of the flower fairies. They are very fond of having fun with the thick people, as they call you, for, like most children, they like fun better than anything else." "Why do you have flowers so near you then? Do they not annoy you?" "Oh, no, they are very amusing, with their mimicries of grown people, and mock solemnities. Sometimes they will act a whole play through before my eyes, with perfect composure and assurance, for they are not afraid of me. Only, as soon as they have done, they burst into peals of tiny laughter, as if it was such a joke to have been serious over anything. These I speak of, however, are the fairies of the garden. They are more staid and educated than those of the fields and woods. Of course they have near relations amongst the wild flowers, but they patronize them, and treat them as country cousins, who know nothing of life, and very little of manners. Now and then, however, they are compelled to envy the grace and simplicity of the natural flowers." "Do they live in the flowers?" I said. "I cannot tell," she replied. "There is something in it I do not understand. Sometimes they disappear altogether, even from me, though I know they are near. They seem to die always with the flowers they resemble, and by whose names they are called, but whether they return to life with the fresh flowers, or, whether it be new flowers, new fairies, I cannot tell. They have as many sorts of dispositions as men and women, while their moods are yet more variable, 20 different expressions will cross their little faces in half a minute. I often amuse myself with watching them, but I have never been able to make personal acquaintance with any of them. If I speak to one, he or she looks up in my face, as if I were not worth heeding, gives a little laugh, and runs away." Here the woman started, as if suddenly recollecting herself, and said in a low voice to her daughter, "Make haste, go and watch him, and see in what direction he goes." I may as well mention here that the conclusion I arrived at from the observations I was afterwards able to make was that the flowers die because the fairies go away, not that the fairies disappear because the flowers die. The flowers seem a sort of houses for them, or outer bodies, which they can put on or off when they please. Just as you could form some idea of the nature of a man from the kind of house he built, if he followed his own taste, so you could, without seeing the fairies, tell what any one of them is like, by looking at the flower till you feel that you understand it. For just what the flower says to you, would the face and form of the fairy say, only so much more plainly as a face and human figure can express more than a flower. For the house or the clothes, though like the inhabitant or the wearer, cannot be wrought into an equal power of utterance. Yet you would see a strange resemblance, almost oneness, between the flower and the fairy, which you could not describe, but which described itself to you. Whether all the flowers have fairies, I cannot determine, any more than I can be sure whether all men and women have souls. The woman and I continued the conversation for a few minutes longer. I was much interested by the information she gave me, and astonished at the language in which she was able to convey it. It seemed that intercourse with the fairies was no bad education in itself. But now the daughter returned with the news that the ash had just gone away in a southwesterly direction, and, as my course seemed to lie eastward, she hoped I should be in no danger of meeting him if I departed at once. I looked out of the little window, and there stood the ash tree, to my eyes the same as before, but I believed that they knew better than I did, and prepared to go. I pulled out my purse, but to my dismay there was nothing in it. The woman with a smile begged me not to trouble myself, for money was not of the slightest use there, and as I might meet with people in my journeys whom I could not recognize to be fairies, it was well I had no money to offer, for nothing offended them so much. They would think, she added, that you were making game of them, and that is their peculiar privilege with regard to us. So we went together into the little garden which sloped down towards the lower part of the wood. Here, to my great pleasure, all was life and bustle. There was still light enough from the day to see a little, and the pale half-moon, halfway to the zenith, was reviving every moment. The whole garden was like a carnival, with tiny, gaily decorated forms, in groups, assemblies, processions, pairs or trios, moving stately on, running about wildly, or sauntering hither or thither. From the cups or boughs of tall flowers, as from balconies, some looked down on the masses below, now bursting with laughter, now grave as owls, but even in their deepest solemnity, seeming only to be waiting for the arrival of the next laugh. Some were launched on a little marshy stream at the bottom, in boats chosen from the heaps of last year's leaves that lay about, curled and withered. These soon sank with him, whereupon they swam ashore and got others. Those who took fresh rose leaves for their boats floated the longest, but for these they had to fight, for the fairy of the rose tree complained bitterly that they were stealing her clothes, and defended her property bravely. "You can't wear half you've got," said some. "Never you mind, I don't choose you to have them, they are my property." "All for the good of the community," said one, and ran off with a great hollow leaf. But the rose fairy sprang after him. What a beauty she was! Only too like a drawing-room young lady, knocked him heels over head as he ran, and recovered her great red leaf. But in the meantime 20 had hurried off in different directions with others just as good, and the little creature sat down and cried, and then, in a pet, sent a perfect pink snowstorm of petals from her tree, leaping from branch to branch, and stamping and shaking and pulling. At last, after another good cry, she chose the biggest she could find, and ran away laughing, to launch her boat amongst the rest. But my attention was first and chiefly attracted by a group of fairies near the cottage, who were talking together around what seemed a last dying primrose. They talked singing, and their talk made a song, something like this. "Sister Snowdrop died before we were born. She came like a bride in a snowy morn. What's a bride? What is snow? Never tried. Do not know. Who told you about her? Little primrose, there cannot do without her. Oh, so sweetly fair. Never fear, she will come, primrose dear. Is she dumb? She'll come by and by. You will never see her. She went home to die's, till the new year. Snowdrop. 'Tis no good to invite her. Primrose is very rude, I will bite her. Oh, you naughty pocket. Look, she drops her head. She deserved it, rocket, and she was nearly dead. To your hammock off with you. And swing alone. No one will laugh with you. No, not one. Now let us moan. And cover her o'er. Primrose is gone. All but the flower. Here's a leaf. Lay her upon it. Follow in grief. Pocket has done it. Deeper, poor creature. Winter may come. He cannot reach her, that is a hum. She is buried, the beauty. Now she is done. That was the duty. Now for the fun. And with a wild laugh they sprang away, most of them towards the cottage. During the latter part of the song talk, they had formed themselves into a funeral procession, two of them bearing poor Primrose, whose death Pocket had hastened by biting her stalk upon one of her own great leaves. They bore her solemnly along some distance, and then buried her under a tree. Although I say her, I saw nothing but the withered primrose flower on its long stalk. Pocket, who had been expelled from the company by common consent, went sulkily away towards her hammock, for she was the fairy of the calcularia, and looked rather wicked. When she reached its stem, she stopped and looked round. I could not help speaking to her, for I stood near her. I said, "Pocket, how could you be so naughty?" "I am never naughty," she said, half crossly, half defiantly, "only if you come near my hammock, I will bite you, and then you will go away." "Why did you bite poor Primrose?" "Because she said we should never see Snowdrop, as if we were not good enough to look at her, and she was, the proud thing. Served her right." "Oh, Pocket, Pocket," said I, but by this time the party which had gone towards the house, rushed out again, shouting and screaming with laughter. Half of them were on the cat's back, and half held on by her fur and tail, or ran beside her, till, more coming to their help, the furious cat was held fast, and they proceeded to pick the sparks out of her with thorns and pins, which they handled like harpoons. Indeed, there were more instruments at work about her than there could have been sparks in her. One little fellow who held on hard by the tip of the tail, with his feet planted on the ground at an angle of 45 degrees, helping to keep her fast, administered a continuous flow of admonitions to Pussy. "Now, Pussy, be patient. You know quite well it is all for your good. You cannot be comfortable with all those sparks in you, and, indeed, I am charitably disposed to believe," here he became very pompous, "that they are the cause of all your bad temper, so we must have them all out, every one, else we shall be reduced to the painful necessity of cutting your claws, and pulling out your eye teeth. Quiet. Pussy, quiet." But with a perfect hurricane of feline curses, the poor animal broke loose, and dashed across the garden and through the hedge, faster than even the fairies could follow. "Never mind, never mind, we shall find her again, and by that time she will have laid in a fresh stock of sparks. Hooray!" And off they set, after some new mischief. But I will not linger to enlarge on the amusing display of these frolicsome creatures. Their manners and habits are now so well known to the world, having been so often described by eyewitnesses, that it would be only indulging self-conceit to add my account in full to the rest. I cannot help wishing, however, that my readers could see them for themselves. Especially do I desire that they should see the Fairy of the Daisy, a little, chubby, round-eyed child, with such innocent trust in his look. Even the most mischievous of the fairies would not tease him, although he did not belong to their set at all, but was quite a little country bumpkin. He wandered about alone, and looked at everything, with his hands in his little pockets, and a white nightcap on, the darling. He was not so beautiful as many other wild flowers I saw afterwards, but so dear and loving in his looks and little confident ways. Chapter 4. When Bale is at highest, Booth is nighest. Ballad of Sir Aldinger. By this time, my hostess was quite anxious that I should be gone. So, with warm thanks for their hospitality, I took my leave, and went my way through the little garden towards the forest. Some of the garden flowers had wandered into the wood, and were growing here and there along the path, but the trees soon became too thick and shadowy for them. I particularly noticed some tall lilies, which grew on both sides of the way, with large dazzlingly white flowers, set off by the universal green. It was now dark enough for me to see that every flower was shining with a light of its own. Indeed, it was by this light that I saw them, an internal, peculiar light, proceeding from each, and not reflected from a common source of light as in the daytime. This light sufficed only for the plant itself, and was not strong enough to cast any but the faintest shadows around it, or to illuminate any of the neighboring objects with other than the faintest tinge of its own individual hue. From the lilies above mentioned, from the campanulas, from the foxgloves, and every bell-shaped flower, curious little figures shot up their heads, peeped at me, and drew back. They seemed to inhabit them, as snails their shells, but I was sure some of them were intruders, and belonged to the gnomes or goblin fairies, who inhabit the ground and earthy creeping plants. From the cups of arum lilies, creatures with great heads and grotesque faces shot up like Jack in the Box, and made grimaces at me, or rose slowly and slyly over the edge of the cup, and spouted water at me, slipping suddenly back, like those little soldier crabs that inhabit the shells of sea snails. Passing a row of tall thistles, I saw them crowded with little faces, which peeped everyone from behind its flower, and drew back as quickly, and I heard them saying to each other, evidently intending me to hear, but the speaker always hiding behind his tuft, when I looked in his direction, look at him. Look at him. He has begun his story without a beginning, and it will never have any end. He. Look at him. But as I went further into the wood, these sights and sounds became fewer, giving way to others of a different character. A little forest of wild hyacinths was alive with exquisite creatures, who stood nearly motionless, with drooping necks, holding each by the stem of her flower, and swaying gently with it, whenever a low breath of wind swung the crowded floral belfry. In like manner, though differing of course in form and meaning, stood a group of harebells, like little angels waiting, ready, till they were wanted to go on some yet unknown message. In darker nooks, by the mossy roots of the trees, or in little tufts of grass, each dwelling in a globe of its own green light, weaving a network of grass in its shadows, glowed the glowworms. They were just like the glowworms of our own land, for they are fairies everywhere, worms in the day, and glowworms at night, when their own can appear, and they can be themselves to others as well as themselves. But they had their enemies here. For I saw great strong-armed beetles, hurrying about with most unwieldy haste, awkward as elephant calves, looking apparently for glowworms, for the moment a beetle espied one, threw it to it was a forest of grass, or an underwood of moss, it pounced upon it, and bore it away, in spite of its feeble resistance. Wondering what their object could be, I watched one of the beetles, and then I discovered a thing I could not account for. But it is no use trying to account for things in fairy land, and one who travels there soon learns to forget the very idea of doing so, and takes everything as it comes, like a child, who, being in a chronic condition of wonder, is surprised at nothing. What I saw was this. Everywhere, here and there over the ground, lay little, dark-looking lumps of something more like earth than anything else, and about the size of a chestnut. The beetles hunted in couples for these, and having found one of them stayed to watch it, while the other hurried to find a glowworm. By signals, I presume, between them, the latter soon found his companion again. They then took the glowworm and held its luminous tail to the dark earthly pellet, when lo, it shot up into the air like a skyrocket, seldom, however, reaching the height of the highest tree. Just like a rocket too, it burst in the air, and fell in a shower of the most gorgeously colored sparks of every variety of hue, golden and red, and purple and green, and blue and rosy fires crossed and intercrossed each other, beneath the shadowy heads, and between the columnar stems of the forest trees. They never used the same glowworm twice, I observed, but let him go, apparently uninjured by the use they had made of him. In other parts, the whole of the immediately surrounding foliage was illuminated by the interwoven dances in the air of splendidly colored fireflies, which sped hither and thither, turned, twisted, crossed, and recrossed, entwining every complexity of intervolved motion. Here and there, whole mighty trees glowed with an emitted phosphorescent light. You could trace the very course of the great roots in the earth by the faint light that came through, and every twig, and every vein on every leaf was a streak of pale fire. All this time, as I went through the wood, I was haunted with the feeling that other shapes, more like my own size and mien, were moving about at a little distance on all sides of me. But as yet I could discern none of them, although the moon was high enough to send a great many of her rays down between the trees, and these rays were unusually bright, and sight-giving, notwithstanding she was only a half-moon. I constantly imagined, however, that forms were visible in all directions except that to which my gaze was turned, and that they only became invisible, or resolved themselves into other woodland shapes, the moment my looks were directed towards them. However this may have been, except for this feeling of presence, the wood seemed utterly bare of anything like human companionship, although my glance often fell on some object which I fancied to be a human form, for I soon found that I was quite deceived, as, the moment I fixed my regard on it, it showed plainly that it was a bush, or a tree, or a rock. Soon a vague sense of discomfort possessed me. With variations of relief, this gradually increased, as if some evil thing were wandering about in my neighborhood, sometimes nearer and sometimes further off, but still approaching. The feeling continued and deepened, until all my pleasure in the shows of various kinds that everywhere betokened the presence of the merry fairies vanished by degrees, and left me full of anxiety and fear, which I was unable to associate with any definite object whatever. At length the thought crossed my mind with horror, can it be possible that the ash is looking for me? Or that, in his nightly wanderings, his path is gradually verging towards mine? I comforted myself, however, by remembering that he had started quite in another direction, one that would lead him, if he kept it, far apart from me, especially as, for the last 2 or 3 hours, I had been diligently journeying eastward. I kept on my way, therefore, striving by direct effort of the will against the encroaching fear, and to this end occupying my mind, as much as I could, with other thoughts. I was so far successful that, although I was conscious, if I yielded for a moment, I should be almost overwhelmed with horror, I was yet able to walk right on for an hour or more. What I feared I could not tell. Indeed, I was left in a state of the vaguest uncertainty as regarded the nature of my enemy, and knew not the mode or object of his attacks, for, somehow or other, none of my questions had succeeded in drawing a definite answer from the dame in the cottage. How then to defend myself I knew not, nor even by what sign I might with certainty recognize the presence of my foe, for as yet this vague though powerful fear was all the indication of danger I had. To add to my distress, the clouds in the west had risen nearly to the top of the skies, and they and the moon were traveling slowly towards each other. Indeed, some of their advance guard had already met her, and she had begun to wade through a filmy vapor that gradually deepened. At length she was for a moment almost entirely obscured. When she shone out again, with a brilliancy increased by the contrast, I saw plainly on the path before me from around which at this spot the trees receded, leaving a small space of greensward the shadow of a large hand, with knotty joints and protuberances here and there. Especially I remarked, even in the midst of my fear, the bulbous points of the fingers. I looked hurriedly all around, but could see nothing from which such a shadow should fall. Now, however, that I had a direction, however undetermined, in which to project my apprehension, the very sense of danger and need of action overcame that stifling which is the worst property of fear. I reflected in a moment, that if this were indeed a shadow, it was useless to look for the object that cast it in any other direction than between the shadow and the moon. I looked, and peered, and intensified my vision, all to no purpose. I could see nothing of that kind, not even an ash tree in the neighborhood. Still the shadow remained, not steady, but moving to and fro, and once I saw the fingers close, and grind themselves close, like the claws of a wild animal, as if in uncontrollable longing for some anticipated prey. There seemed but one mode left of discovering the substance of this shadow. I went forward boldly, though with an inward shudder which I would not heed, to the spot where the shadow lay, threw myself on the ground, laid my head within the form of the hand, and turned my eyes towards the moon. Good heavens! What did I see? I wonder that ever I arose, and that the very shadow of the hand did not hold me where I lay until fear had frozen my brain. I saw the strangest figure, vague, shadowy, almost transparent, in the central parts, and gradually deepening in substance towards the outside, until it ended in extremities capable of casting such a shadow as fell from the hand, through the awful fingers of which I now saw the moon. The hand was uplifted in the attitude of a paw about to strike its prey. But the face, which throbbed with fluctuating and pulsatory visibility not from changes in the light it reflected, but from changes in its own conditions of reflecting power, the alterations being from within, not from without, it was horrible. I do not know how to describe it. It caused a new sensation. Just as one cannot translate a horrible odor, or a ghastly pain, or a fearful sound, into words, so I cannot describe this new form of awful hideousness. I can only try to describe something that is not it, but seems somewhat parallel to it, or at least is suggested by it. It reminded me of what I had heard of vampires, for the face resembled that of a corpse more than anything else I can think of, especially when I can conceive such a face in motion, but not suggesting any life as the source of the motion. The features were rather handsome than otherwise, except the mouth, which had scarcely a curve in it. The lips were of equal thickness, but the thickness was not at all remarkable, even although they looked slightly swollen. They seemed fixedly open, but were not wide apart. Of course I did not remark these lineaments at the time, I was too horrified for that. I noted them afterwards, when the form returned on my inward sight with a vividness too intense to admit of my doubting the accuracy of the reflex. But the most awful of the features were the eyes. These were alive, yet not with life. They seemed lighted up with an infinite greed. A gnawing voracity, which devoured the devourer, seemed to be the indwelling and propelling power of the whole ghostly apparition. I lay for a few moments simply embruted with terror, when another cloud, obscuring the moon, delivered me from the immediately paralyzing effects of the presence to the vision of the object of horror, while it added the force of imagination to the power of fear within me, inasmuch as, knowing far worse cause for apprehension than before, I remained equally ignorant from what I had to defend myself, or how to take any precautions, he might be upon me in the darkness any moment. I sprang to my feet, and sped I knew not whither, only away from the specter. I thought no longer of the path, and often narrowly escaped dashing myself against a tree, in my headlong flight of fear. Great drops of rain began to patter on the leaves. Thunder began to mutter, then growl in the distance. I ran on. The rain fell heavier. At length the thick leaves could hold it up no longer, and, like a second firmament, they poured their torrents on the earth. I was soon drenched, but that was nothing. I came to a small swollen stream that rushed through the woods. I had a vague hope that if I crossed this stream, I should be in safety from my pursuer, but I soon found that my hope was as false as it was vague. I dashed across the stream, ascended a rising ground, and reached a more open space, where stood only great trees. Through them I directed my way, holding eastward as nearly as I could guess, but not at all certain that I was not moving in an opposite direction. My mind was just reviving a little from its extreme terror, when, suddenly, a flash of lightning, or rather a cataract of successive flashes, behind me, seemed to throw on the ground in front of me, but far more faintly than before, from the extent of the source of the light, the shadow of the same horrible hand. I sprang forward, stung to yet wilder speed, but had not run many steps before my foot slipped, and, vainly attempting to recover myself, I fell at the foot of one of the large trees. Half stunned, I yet raised myself, and almost involuntarily looked back. All I saw was the hand within 3 feet of my face. But, at the same moment, I felt two large soft arms thrown round me from behind, and a voice like a woman said, "Do not fear the goblin, he dares not hurt you now." With that, the hand was suddenly withdrawn as from a fire, and disappeared in the darkness and the rain. Overcome with the mingling of terror and joy, I lay for some time almost insensible. The first thing I remember is the sound of a voice above me, full and low, and strangely reminding me of the sound of a gentle wind amidst the leaves of a great tree. It murmured over and over again, "I may love him, I may love him, for he is a man, and I am only a beech tree." I found I was seated on the ground, leaning against a human form, and supported still by the arms around me, which I knew to be those of a woman who must be rather above the human size, and largely proportioned. I turned my head, but without moving otherwise, for I feared lest the arms should untwine themselves, and clear, somewhat mournful eyes met mine. At least that is how they impressed me, but I could see very little of color or outline as we sat in the dark and rainy shadow of the tree. The face seemed very lovely, and solemn from its stillness, with the aspect of one who is quite content, but waiting for something. I saw my conjecture from her arms was correct, she was above the human scale throughout, but not greatly. "Why do you call yourself a beech tree?" I said. "Because I am one," she replied, in the same low, musical, murmuring voice. "You are a woman," I returned. "Do you think so? Am I very like a woman then?" "You are a very beautiful woman. Is it possible you should not know it?" "I am very glad you think so. I fancy I feel like a woman sometimes. I do so tonight and always when the rain drips from my hair. For there is an old prophecy in our woods that one day we shall all be men and women like you. Do you know anything about it in your region? Shall I be very happy when I am a woman? I fear not, for it is always in nights like these that I feel like one. But I long to be a woman for all that." I had let her talk on, for her voice was like a solution of all musical sounds. I now told her that I could hardly say whether women were happy or not. I knew one who had not been happy, and for my part, I had often longed for fairyland, as she now longed for the world of men. But then neither of us had lived long, and perhaps people grew happier as they grew older. Only I doubted it. I could not help sighing. She felt the sigh, for her arms were still round me. She asked me how old I was. 21, said I. "Why, you baby," said she, and kissed me with the sweetest kiss of winds and odors. There was a cool faithfulness in the kiss that revived my heart wonderfully. I felt that I feared the dreadful ash no more. "What did the horrible ash want with me?" I said. "I am not quite sure, but I think he wants to bury you at the foot of his tree. But he shall not touch you, my child." "Are all the ash trees as dreadful as he?" "Oh, no. They are all disagreeable, selfish creatures. What horrid men they will make, if it be true. But this one has a hole in his heart that nobody knows of but one or two, and he is always trying to fill it up, but he cannot. That must be what he wanted you for. I wonder if he will ever be a man. If he is, I hope they will kill him." "How kind of you to save me from him." "I will take care that he shall not come near you again. But there are some in the wood more like me, from whom, alas, I cannot protect you. Only if you see any of them very beautiful, try to walk round them. What then? I cannot tell you more. But now I must tie some of my hair about you, and then the ash will not touch you. Here, cut some off. You men have strange cutting things about you. She shook her long hair loose over me, never moving her arms. I cannot cut your beautiful hair. It would be a shame. Not cut my hair. It will have grown long enough before any is wanted again in this wild forest. Perhaps it may never be of any use again, not till I am a woman. And she sighed. As gently as I could, I cut with a knife a long tress of flowing, dark hair, she hanging her beautiful head over me. When I had finished, she shuddered and breathed deep, as one does when an acute pain, steadfastly endured without sign of suffering, is at length relaxed. She then took the hair and tied it round me, singing a strange, sweet song, which I could not understand, but which left in me a feeling like this. I saw thee ne'er before, I see thee never more, but love, and help, and pain, beautiful one, have made thee mine, till all my years are done. I cannot put more of it into words. She closed her arms about me again, and went on singing. The rain in the leaves, and a light wind that had arisen, kept her song company. I was wrapped in a trance of still delight. It told me the secret of the woods, and the flowers, and the birds. At one time I felt as if I was wandering in childhood through sunny spring forests, over carpets of primroses, anemones, and little white starry things I had almost said creatures, and finding new wonderful flowers at every turn. At another, I lay half dreaming in the hot summer noon, with a book of old tales beside me, beneath a great beech, or, in autumn, grew sad because I trod on the leaves that had sheltered me, and received their last blessing in the sweet odors of decay, or, in a winter evening, frozen still, looked up, as I went home to a warm fireside, through the netted boughs and twigs to the cold, snowy moon, with her opal zone around her. At last I had fallen asleep, for I know nothing more that passed till I found myself lying under a superb beech tree, in the clear light of the morning, just before sunrise. Around me was a girdle of fresh beech leaves. Alas! I brought nothing with me out of fairyland, but memories, memories. The great boughs of the beech hung drooping around me. At my head rose its smooth stem, with its great sweeps of curving surface that swelled like undeveloped limbs. The leaves and branches above kept on the song which had sung me asleep,